Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. In this conversation, held on November 4th, 2019, as part of the Works in Progress series, artists Alex Braden and Emily Francisco discuss how they develop collaborative projects in relation to their independent artistic and curatorial practices. Last year, Braden and Francisco created Bipedal Soundscapes, the inaugural Arlington Art Truck activation that involved participants pedaling a stationary bike to power a five-tiered turntable housing vinyl records. Each visitor created their own unique audio experience by controlling the speed of the turntable through their pedaling.
Thank you all for joining us for round two of this conversation. So Alex and I were introduced through the Transformer E11 program focusing on sound, where we were invited to make work for a speaker wall that consisted of 12 channels. We had a lead mentor and worked with a number of artists over a series of weeks, and we were given these parameters for the sound design. And so
that's right. So as Emily said, it was a 14-channel speaker wall. I, at the time, was residing with my in-laws temporarily. And instead of being inhibited by freedom, which is sometimes how I feel when composing, I decided to create a piece based on sounds that I could find within the confines of the house or sounds that I could make inside the house. So I created a piece of music. It was about 13 minutes in length and five movements. And we'll listen to a couple of excerpts from that.
So for me as a sculptor, primarily working with found objects, I approached this prompt much like I do my sculptures. And so I took a decade's worth of existing recordings as a starting point. So recordings that I had between 2004 and 2014 of just various sound projects I'd been working on. And I used those as a basis and ended up, as a basis for the project and ended up making a three-part composition. And so we mentioned that this was a 14-channel speaker wall. So in order to make work targeted for the zones, we had to build these massive audio projects and then export each section. I did 7 in stereo, which gave me 14 channels. And I built it much like I would a sculpture. And I approached the project very structurally.
Yeah.
So I'll let Alex take the reins on this particular project.
Sure. So No Sharps, No Flats was a very collaborative effort. The idea for the installation was that I wanted to have 30 different composers contribute to a piece individually. So I set parameters at 120 beats per minute and the key of C major, and asked, again, 30 different people to compose a piece in their own timbre with no other restrictions. Then I recorded each of those pieces to cassette, and along with Emily and Adam, another collaborator of ours, built a structure that housed all of these cassette tapes. And the idea was that listeners could come and play or stop each piece as they saw fit, essentially curating their own version of harmony within the piece. But then the second layer of it was, given the nature of the medium, by the end of the installation, it had fallen, you know, from it come from this very harmonious start and fallen into complete entropic dissidence. The tape had stretched, the machines were falling apart, which gave it a very interesting level of time. So we have two videos. One is a studio recording of a sample of all of the pieces, and then the second is some video from the last day where you can kind of hear what happened as time took its toll.
For the sake of brevity, we'll move forward to a project that we started discussing in 2015 that came into fruition in April 2018. Bipedal Soundscapes was commissioned by Arlington Cultural Affairs, and the project was designed specifically to be portable. The idea was that we could pack it up and take it anywhere. It's a five-tier turntable system powered by a stationary bike. And so the miter gear was actually one of the hand crank drills that I modified to house the belt and drive the turntables. And we took this project to a number of activation sites, a number of events. We also went to various schools and discuss the project with kids. This is a quick excerpt.
I definitely lean more to the audio side of art, and she leans more toward the sculptural side, but we intersect on almost everything.
I tend to work on structures that generate sound, and so it's nice working with Alex because I can focus on the machine and Alex can focus on what it sounds like.
Because you can control the pitch and the scratches and the screeching at some point, it kind of just redefines all the audio.
The speed of the bicycle determines the speed of the records as they turn, and then if we attach an additional belt, it will also charge the battery that powers the device.
So it's completely self-sustaining. You can plop it anywhere you like, and it'll work. Essentially converts human energy into audio.
So as you can hear, there are a lot of just commercially pressed records. We used a lot of go-go and a lot of spoken word. That wasn't initially the plan when we developed this project. Alex actually did a pretty intense field recording project, which ended up becoming its own piece. And so if you want to talk about that a little bit more.
Yeah, it's a similar idea, but I went, being that the project was local to Arlington, I just went within the confines of the county and recorded anything that I thought interesting and chopped it up and turned it into a 5-channel piece of music, sent that off and got it pressed to vinyl. And if you're good with your timing, you can listen to everything simultaneously, as we will in a second.
Separately, we make work using very different processes, and so the work that we make individually looks very and sounds very different than the work we make together. However, bipedal soundscapes ended up resembling my first sound sculpture much more than I originally planned, where I'd taken an exercise bike and used the handles to basically create a turntable, but I was using the wheel of the bike to turn the record. So this piece really was chewing up the record as it went, but it was fairly durable considering the circumstances. The wheel turned the record, and you can see the frame has basically a section cut out with an angle grinder that I used to jam the record in to make contact with the wheel.
Thank you.
So moving forward for the sake of brevity, it's difficult to pinpoint a chronology when talking about my work because a project, I might not know what it's going to be when I start working on it. And so the piano keyboard that I used for the transharmonium, well, I built the transharmonium between 2011 and 12. I used a piano that I had deconstructed in 2005 in front of a Value Village in St. Louis. And I called a couple of friends. We pulled it apart as much as we could to shove it in the back of the minivan that I had at the time. And I transported it to Webster University's campus, moving at about 10 miles an hour with my hatch hanging open. And I used that for a number of projects, for a number of performances. And at one point, it was an architectural element in one of my apartments. And then when I moved to DC, I brought the keyboard with me and used it to develop an 88-switch, 43-radio keyboard. So it can be tuned within a system. Typically, I'll tune to classical radio. What it's playing is live radio feeds using the clock radios. And so depending on where this piece is set up, those are the radio frequencies you have to work with. So it'll be very different in DC than it is 30 miles out in Virginia or in St. Louis. I was getting a lot of country radio. And this piece has primarily been on display around DC and Virginia, unfortunately. And it spent a little time in St. Louis, so I haven't had a chance to get a full national sampling. That, of course, was the first project I started with deconstructed radios, and with it being such an intense, time-consuming project, I developed some smaller projects so that I could at least have the gratification of finishing something. And so the first piece that I finished in the radio projects was a violin that is wired so each string is its own radio station, but then the bow completes the connection on each side. So when you play it, you're activating four live radio channels. I think you guys get the idea. So, something I realized while working on these projects was that RCA signal can be split in the same way that audio signal is, and you can really switch out the chords in many situations. And so, using my home television and a chord I cut in half, I tested this, and once it worked, I built a harpsichord that played a series of surveillance cameras. And so, there was a harpsichord slated for the dumpster. It was given to my studio instead. And I built a switcher so that whenever you play the harpsichord, you trigger a series of keys that finish the connection in a surveillance camera. So if you're looking at this piece and nobody's playing it, you have You have 12 channels of just blank blue screens, but once you start playing the keyboard, it activates the 12 surveillance cameras that are also color tinted. And lastly, I'll show you some erasure music projects I was doing. I've been doing a number of projects with music boxes in part of an effort to scale down. And very similar to the de Kooning Rauschenberg erasure drawing, I started making erasure music. So naturally for me, making a video doesn't really feel like the project's complete, so I always have to find a way to house the project. This particular video, I made a portable video installation in a box to display this particular video. As far as performances go, I try typically not to perform. I tend to make objects that perform themselves, but on occasion I will do live performances. So this is a still from a live performance of creating erasure music. But moving directly forward into studio images. So as I mentioned earlier, chronology is difficult with my work because when people go into my studio, they don't really know particularly what's going on. They don't know if I'm a musician and why I have all of these brutalized instruments. Not so much brutalized. I'm always very careful in the deconstruction. So I had a studio residency at Artisphere that ended up picking up the aftermath of my thesis, one of my thesis projects in grad school, which was a performance where a widow came to me with her husband's piano and asked me to deconstruct the piano and make a piece in exchange for her family. So with this piano being far more pristine than anything I'd previously worked with, it only made sense to deconstruct the piano as part of a public performance over a course of 3 weeks. And so at the end of the performance, there was a looping surveillance video of the process. And then those contents were moved to my studio at Artisphere, where I completed the obligation within the contract. And so this was the initial piece that I made for the family. So structurally, everything that came out of the previous piece, everything used to build the previous piece, was strictly out of the piano. I allowed myself a little more flexibility in building a toy piano and in using an actual manufactured toy piano harp. But then again, the pieces of the piano. So this piece currently sits where the grand piano once sat. I found that it's easy to obtain pianos when people find out that part of your studio practice is deconstructing pianos. You start getting a lot of cold contacts from people that are trying to dispose of these sentimental objects. And so these are images from my graduate studio where I was working on a number of simultaneous projects. I did another residency at Montgomery College, but then after doing having graduate school and then doing a 9-month studio residency and then moving around, it's really exhausting moving piano, so I decided to set up a more permanent studio and did so in a federal-style apartment with an enclosed porch, and that didn't particularly work out too well because my furnace set the floor on fire and set me back productivity-wise a great deal. So I recently moved into studio. We got our permit to occupy at the end of May, and we all moved in the beginning of June. This was during the construction phase, and then I went in and built a massive storage loft that I call Loft Livia, after a dear coworker of mine. And then I managed to empty my storage unit. So in the top corner, you can see no sharps, no flats, in its beautiful green cellophane, and a number of other past projects housed up in the vast ceiling space. And then just before I pass over the clicker to Alex, I'm going to quickly clarify something that was misreported, where NBC apparently had been told that all of my work was destroyed in a fire, which is not true. and they seemed to think this was the only piece that survived, but all of my finished work was in a storage unit at the time of the fire, so it was mainly works in progress and materials that got damaged. So,
every piece you show should be the one that survived. It'll always sell. We're going to check out a couple of videos from my past work. We're going to begin with an installation entitled A Lesser Light. A Lesser Light occupied a space for a little over a month. I did 4 movements for this piece. Each one was up for about a week. The piece was an 8-channel installation, so we had 8 speakers in an oval surrounding the listening area. And for each of these movements, I composed between 100 and 300 shorts pertaining to a theme. And using a series of CD players, I was able to randomly play from this list of shorts from each one of these speakers such that the resulting sounds, or music, however you define it, would never repeat itself and was infinite in its realization. So we will first listen to a bit from Andy, Did You Hear About This One? And we'll also be able to see some photos from the installation. Another part of this installation was a piece called Tolling, Womb to Tomb. And the very simplest way to put it is I took the information that I discovered about the worldwide birth and death rate per day and distilled it into a BPM, divided that amongst the speakers such that certain sounds could or would line up with the actual death rate and the actual birth rate for the planet. Certain sounds. Reverse sounds, for example, would be death, and strikes would be birth. Tuned them to a key and unleashed them. At the closing, we had a dance performance. You'll see some images from that. Those dancers are Antonius Bowie and Mercedes Stephanie, who are also part of the Halcyon cohort that preceded mine. The last piece from A Lesser Light that we'll listen to is called Themes and Variations for Piano in F Major. Same idea, 300 shorts in same key, affected piano mainly, and let's see what that sounds like. We're going to rewind the clock a bit. So a few years ago, after Freddie Gray was murdered by the Baltimore Police Department, I started working on a piece. I grew up in Detroit, Michigan, and I had a lot of cops in the family, and I suffered a good amount of misinformation about civil rights and the criminal justice system. And so I created a piece with... you'll see a steel drum that's housing a subwoofer, and the subwoofer is slowly tearing apart some hardware that's been attached to the top. And Freddie was killed in a process that was previously called a nickel ride. He's in the back of a paddy wagon when he died, or right before he died. And outside, the steel drum will listen to a piece by Peggy Lee, also entitled Nickel Ride, but describing a much different experience for her.
Bonjour, Lucille. Time off when I used to walk around the midway, pitch pennies, see the plastic cats and tossing rings, Cupid dolls and all those things. Used to feel sorry for those poor old geeks.
Quickly, we'll check out, I occasionally create pieces in old telephones, and this one explains itself. You lift the receiver to listen to the work. We'll just listen to a quick bit of it.
Yes, Littletooth just couldn't seem to behave himself. He wasn't really bad, but it just seemed he was always getting into trouble. You see, Littletooth was a tugboat. And a tugboat is supposed to pull the big ships around the harbor. That's what Little Tooth's father did. His name was Big Tooth, and when he blew his whistle, it sounded like this. But when Little Tooth blew his whistle, it sounded like this.
If I decide to run, you'll have the great pleasure of voting for the man that will easily go down as the greatest president in the history of the United States.
It continues. We don't need to listen to that voice too much. I'm going to skip this last piece so that we can tell you about an upcoming installation. Here's my studio. Bit of a mess. So we have something opening up shortly. It's our most recent collaboration. We've decided to investigate the wide world of VHS. So we have a...
Moving forward with technology.
Yeah, so we're currently installing a wall of TVs and monitors that are connected to VCRs, and we're also dubbing dozens of original VHS content. Visitors can watch up as many of the VHS as they choose, selecting from a library and inserting into our brain of VHS. Each of the VHS has some audio associated with it that's going to essentially create a piece of its own. That opens on the 16th, is that correct?
Correct. Well, it opens on the 11th, but the reception is on the 16th. And so this particular space is... So with Brentwood Arts Exchange, there's the main gallery and the lab gallery. Our work is going into the lab gallery, so the parameters with this piece... I'm giggling because Spencer's here. But... Our initial idea didn't exactly work out too well because it took a bit too much of the gallery space. So we reconfigured and basically are developing what will serve as a theater with one big wall of both flat screens and CRTs, and the visitor, as Alex said, will be invited to activate the piece, selecting their own VHS tapes. So we are... in the process of installing, we've pretty much mapped things out, and that's about it as far as the install goes. So, all right.
That's it.
So, thank you, guys.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.